Well, as you pointed out before, these programs, these jobs are being threatened, let's be clear about it, particularly by the Republicans in Congress, but Democrats as well, who are supported by the fossil fuel industry. Obama came into office making a lot of promises about renewable energy. Few of them have been fulfilled, but I think probably not as much as we would like. What do you think the stakes are here in the coming election, and what do people need to know about the kinds of job creation policies that could be put forward by the federal government?
President Obama, since before he became president, even when he was campaigning, made renewable energy a significant piece of his energy policy. And he's been consistent in his support for the kinds of policies that will allow us to move renewable energy forward. Just actually a couple of weeks ago, he was in Newton, Iowa, speaking at one of those plants I described, and he was talking about the need to renew the production tax credit that, as you said, is being threatened largely by Republican opposition, but it's not solely by Republican opposition. He also, in March of this year, tried to get the Congress to move forward with a reduction in the massive subsidies to the oil and gas industries to the tune of $4 billion a year. And unfortunately, Congress blocked him in that effort. So he, I think, has really set a fine presidential example in identifying the priorities that we need to move forward with in our energy field. Mitt Romney has a very different vision of our energy future. He seems to disdain wind power and hardly mentions the word climate change. He has a kind of drill, baby drill attitude about energy policy that really takes us back to before the first oil embargo. And I think really presents a very, very different picture of what America would look like going into the 21st century than President Obama. Interestingly, where wind power is being developed is often in states that are quite heavily Republican, and the rank and file in those states are supportive of wind power because they see the jobs creation, they see the benefits in terms of the local tax bases, and they see the source of pride of building a new factory or building an educational program that is training people for an up-and-coming technology. Yet the political leaders are lagging behind the public in many ways in recognizing this opportunity and this need.
Also, Philip Warburg, in your book, Harvest the Wind, you get into the controversies over wind. You've already spoken about Ted Kennedy. I think that was a disappointment to all of us. You point out that his view really would not have been all that much ruined by Cape Wind, since it's pretty would be pretty far on the horizon. But you do. I was surprised by some of the information that you give around the controversy over noise and the environmental effects on wildlife like birds and bats. That was a fascinating discussion. Tell us, what are the problems, the environmental problems of wind, and how is the wind energy, wind industry addressing them?
Well, I should say there is no such thing as clean energy. I think we have to talk about cleaner energy and dirtier energy. And wind power, like any large-scale technology, will have its impacts on the environment. Noise is a concern. Noise from wind turbines can be controlled by the proper siting of those wind farms, and that is happening in many areas. This is a technology that has developed very quickly, and in some ways it has developed ahead of the regulatory process, and the regulatory process is scrambling to catch up. So wind noise is a good example. Turbines generate noise. If you site a turbine sufficiently far from the nearest residential building, that might be 1,000 feet, it might be 2,000 feet, it depends upon the topography, it depends upon a number of factors, then people will not be disturbed by the noise generated by wind turbines. But if people are living in very close proximity to turbines, they can produce noise that can be annoying. And so we have to get smart about that, and states and localities can't just go at it in an ad hoc way. They have to come up with good, sound regulations that might set minimum distances, should set maximum noise levels that can be heard from outside the nearest residential building. And that is happening in a number of areas. But wind farms have been built over the past 20, 30 years, and not all of them comport with the best siting standards. So we're having to watch an industry play catch up in that regard. In terms of wildlife impacts, the primary concerns are birds and bats. And wind turbines do kill some birds and some bats. These are, again, very large blades that are spinning quite fast. If you look at their blade tips, they're going about 200 miles an hour at their blade tips, even though they may be rotating at only 16 to 20 revolutions per minute. And in some areas, especially areas where older wind farms placed wind turbines very close together and the turbines were closer to the ground, there have been some serious problems with bird kill of, for example, eagles in California at the Altamont wind farm, where what they're doing now is they're replacing a lot of the smaller, older, more quickly spinning turbines that are closer to the ground with taller turbines that are more generously spaced and that pose a much, much lower risk to various kinds of predatory fowl, like predatory birds like the golden eagle. If you look at the raw numbers, and people who are opposed to wind power often cite those numbers, and they sound frightening, about 90,000 birds are probably being killed by wind turbines today. Now, a lot of those birds are common birds, so there is less concern. I mean, clearly we don't want to see large numbers of birds of any kind killed, but we're particularly concerned about vulnerable or endangered species. But we've got to look again at the human presence on the landscape. Buildings, collisions with buildings, probably are responsible for somewhere between 100 million and a billion bird deaths per year. It's estimated that household cats in America kill about a billion birds per year. And cars, colliding with cars, kills about 80 million or so birds per year. So we're talking about very different orders of magnitude, and it's a problem that we need to address. That impact is one that we need to minimize, but I think we have to look at it in contrast to, for example, the utter devastation of landscapes and ecosystems that we see happening when we go and employ mountaintop removal techniques for coal mining or strip mining techniques in the West for coal mining. When we think about what fracking might be doing to our water supplies and is already doing to our air quality in major areas where we have gas production proliferating, looking at nuclear power and the huge displacement of human populations that we've seen happen in the wake of the Chernobyl and Fukushima disasters. So, yes, there are these issues that we need to address, but we also need to put those problems in a context.
So finally, Philip Warburg, I want to ask you about the global competition around wind. I mean, we're hearing some pretty dire predictions about the U.S. losing its edge, that it's going to be edged out by China, possibly India, certainly by Europe, although Europe itself is having some of its own disasters right now, economic disasters. What's it going to mean for the U.S. economy if we do not pursue the policies that are going to put wind and, for that matter, solar power front and center?
Well, I think it's really been a very sad commentary that we began to talk about renewable energy back in the 1970s. Jimmy Carter set a goal of achieving 20% reliance upon renewable energy by the year 2000, and we clearly missed that one by a long shot. We need to have a vision, and we need our technology and our industry to match that that vision. And that means that we need to provide the right kinds of signals so that we're developing technologies that are technologies of the future and not of the past. So we need to reorient our economic signals. For example, if we could introduce a carbon tax that would internalize the actual costs to our environment of burning carbon-based fuels, we would have a very different view of solar power and wind power because it would be they would be seen as much more competitive. That kind of tax system is unlikely to move forward in the near future, so we do need to provide subsidies to the renewable energy industries and support for those industries that help level the playing field. We do face right now a very competitive global climate. One of the advantages that wind power has, again, because the technology is so large, that there's an incentive to build the technology in America. But even so, we're seeing subsidized wind towers, for example, from China coming into the United States, and the Department of Commerce has recently imposed a tariff on those towers because it feels that they're violating international trade agreements. We have to be on our toes. We have to provide the right signals at the national level. We need states to show leadership. And in many ways, our states have been front and center in promoting renewable energy and specifically wind. I mentioned before California's 33% by 2020 renewable portfolio standard. Many other states have set those kinds of standards, and they're very important drivers to make sure that we are developing the technology and installing the technology that will help us shift away from fossil and nuclear fuels toward renewable energy.
Well, this is just a wonderful book, and it's a great read as well. Harvest the Wind, America's Journey to Jobs, Energy Independence, and Climate Stability. Thanks so much for talking with us, Philip Warburg.
It's been my pleasure. Can I mention that there's one anecdote about birds, because I feel like I gave the kind of grim numbers, but not an example of how...
Yeah, please do.
So wind developers have come up with some very creative ways to minimize the adverse impact of wind farms on birds. There's a wind farm in Bulgaria, for example, that's on a major flyway. And what that wind farm has done is it has an on-site ornithologist who is monitoring major migratory patterns by radar. And when bird flocks are approaching the wind farm, that ornithologist is authorized to halt the turbines. And those turbines can be halted within 5 seconds. And there was recently a flock of 30,000 white storks that flew over this wind farm. And in the course of a 2-day period, the ornithologist ordered the turbines to stop 37 times. Not a single white stork was harmed during that flyover. So there really are ways to help adapt the technology to be sensitive to the surrounding environment and in particular to concerns about bird life.
That's wonderful. There's a report from the Energy Information Administration that shows that new wind generation is soon going to be cheaper than new coal.
That's true. What has happened is the Obama administration has introduced some quite tough standards, which are long overdue, for coal-fired power production. New coal-fired power plants under the new source performance standards will have to meet CO2 emission standards that are the equivalent of gas-fired power plants. Now, gas-fired power plants also produce carbon emissions, but at a significantly lower level than coal. So to build a new coal plant under those new regulations will be quite an expensive proposition. Wind power today in well-sited areas can generate electricity at about 5 to 7 cents per kilowatt hour. Now that's with the production tax credit I mentioned, so it's about 7 to 9 cents without the tax credit. We could be seeing new coal up around 13 cents per kilowatt hour in order to meet those new standards. So you're not likely to see new coal plants built with that kind of a differential.
Well, thanks again. This has been terrific.
Thank you so much.